Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
I'm George Chen, and you're listening to SupDoc, a show where we discuss documentaries with our guests from the worlds of comedy, film, and more. We're talking music docs all month long for our October series. On today's episode, I talked to Tyler Hubby, the director of Tony Conrad, Completely in the Present. Tony Conrad was a musician, video artist, and educator, but those words feel limiting. He was sort of like a zealig, ubiquitous character that popped up throughout pivotal moments in the 20th century American avant-garde, and he kept evolving and working up to his death last year in 2016. Tyler Hubby has edited over 30 documentary films, including The Devil and Daniel Johnston, which I interviewed him about for Rocktober bonus episode you can find in our feed. This is Tyler's debut film as a director. We're excited to meet up with him and discuss his work and, of course, the late, great Tony Conrad. Don't know a lot about you. Tyler, thank you for letting us hang out in the garage.
Sure.
Space. It looks like you're working on other stuff.
Yeah.
The classic 3x5s.
Mm-hmm.
And is that a skull of Bruce Willis above there? Or what? Who's that?
Oh, that sculpture is a self-portrait that
that's
I made
you. Like okay.
20-something years ago in clay.
Yeah. Now, you went to SFAI? Is
yes,
that
I
right?
Did.
Is that undergrad?
For undergrad, are you okay. familiar with it?
I am. I'm from Oakland.
Oh, okay.
And I knew a lot of people that went there.
Oh, there you go.
And maybe different era. What class were you?
95.
95, okay. I think that's a bit before the most of the people I knew. I knew some people that went there like more like grad school-y. But they might, yeah, it would have started around a little after that.
I was 92 to 95. I sort of was a community college veteran.
Yeah, which so, community? Bay Area?
Yeah.
Which one?
I was went to De Anza College.
Okay, South Bay.
Down in Cupertino, yeah. California.
San Jose, dude.
All right, well, there you go.
You grew up, where'd you go to high school?
I went to high school at Menlo Atherton High School up the peninsula.
Okay, heard of it?
There was a lot of divorces and second marriage stuff that forced me to move around a bit. But yeah, I lived down in that South Bay area.
Yeah. Bellarmine.
Oh, okay. Sure.
Yeah. Rivals.
Played your water polo team.
Oh, you played water polo?
Yeah.
Okay. would not have pegged you for water polo. I feel like in that era,
your guests.
Is this off the record?
The artists are jocks.
Well,
that
I mean,
blows the mythology.
My era, the water polo guys were really into Rush. I don't know what you guys were into.
Oh, well, you know, I was not a great fit mm-hmm. in the water polo team. Like, I kind of played along, and I was in shape and blonde, and I was mm-hmm. a swimmer.
Oh, but, you have to be blonde after that, yeah.
But I was really into horror movies, and I was a theater nerd, and mm-hmm. it kind of drifted in that direction, and then I ended up eventually at art school.
Mm-hmm.
So I was kind of like, you know.
Was there good De Anza classes?
Yeah, I mean, this is back in the 80s, right, that I was there. So one of the reasons I was drawn to going there is you could basically, first semester, start 16mm production classes.
Whoa.
So De Anza College at that time, even though Foothill College would have been closer for me, mm-hmm. and where a lot of people I knew went to school, and they have, you know, the amazing
radio station
yeah. KFJC. But De Anza had this film program uh-huh. where you could do... They had a complete 16mm film program with flatbed editing, sound dubbing labs, Nagras, sync sound cameras. I mean, they had all of it there, and you could just jump right in. And so that's what I did. I'd been making Super 8 films since I was in junior high school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so for me, it was just like, you know, just let me get the hands on the gear.
Yeah,
I'll figure out what I want to do. And so, And I was a terrible high school student. I had no grades barely to speak of. So I was sort of destined for community college.
Well, it's good that they had all the facilities there to get you.
Yeah, into. Yeah. I can't imagine what it must be like now. You know, I'm sure they've got some computers there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was like, yeah, like even the technology you're talking about. I took a class in film production kind of in the late 90s at the very tail end of where it would be two VHS decks. And then there's like basically like a video mixer between the VHS.
Like maybe decks. An Amiga computer.
I'm trying to think. This was actually no computer. It was at UC Berkeley, and it was like I think a year later they started doing Avid stuff. So I learned like basically like, oh, this is just like when I would make a mixtape, like, you know, for like someone I liked or something. Like
sure.
It was the same idea for that stuff. So yeah, I never figured out the Super 8 stuff. So late 80s, you're at SFAI.
I was at SFAI in the early 90s. Like 92 to 95, you know.
And I saw something you wrote about the Kuchars, or like you worked with them, or...
Well, yeah, George Kuchar was one of my teachers, and I'd become friendly with him. I mean, I would actually go and, you know, cat sit for him when he was out of town, because we lived a couple blocks away from each other.
Nice.
And I'd see him when he'd come through Los Angeles doing shows at Film Forum or, you know, Cinematheque or something like that.
And so you were in school for film? Is that what you went to do? Or is it kind of more like...
I was technically a film student, but I was also spending a lot of time in the photography department. And I was involved in a little bit in the new genres department, which was really where video and performance and kind of sound art, and, you know, everything that didn't fit painting, printmaking, sculpture, film and photography, everything else went to new genres. Like a lot of people there, you know, we were encouraged to be as interdisciplinary as possible. And I'm glad that I didn't stay solely in the film department. But at the end of the day, I was like, I'm a filmmaker, you know, because I've maintained a photography practice for 25 years as well.
I make my living as a filmmaker.
Yeah.
I know. Is Tony Labatt the new genres guy?
Yeah.
I've heard a lot of stories about this dude.
Yeah. Tony was there when I was there. He was my teacher when I was there. I'm still in touch with him a little bit.
And very infamously did one thing. I guess it's kind of an early, like, essentially kidnapping a guy or something along those lines.
I don't know if he talks about that.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Well, I don't know. He's done a lot of crazy stuff. I don't know. Maybe I've heard about the kidnapping story. It sounds familiar, but there's another story, you know, where he interacted with Tony Conrad up in Buffalo, New York.
Oh.
That's a pretty insane...
this did not make it in your film?
No, okay. Because I didn't interview Tony Labatt for the movie. But Tony Labatt told me the story himself.
Yeah, I want to hear this story. Let's get into that.
And I've heard other people tell versions of this story that include details that Tony Labatt had actually left out when he told me this story.
Something that did not make it in the film. Let's hear about it.
So when I met Tony Conrad, I was actually still a student at San Francisco Art Institute. And I'd met Tony Conrad because this guy named Jeff Hunt was living in my apartment in San Francisco and starting this record label, and was going on and on and on about Tony Conrad and Faust and him putting this record out. And I'd never heard of this record. I was like, I don't know this record at all, but I've heard of this filmmaker named Tony Conrad. You know, there's a guy who made a Flickr movie named Tony Conrad, and Jeff Hunt saying, yes, this is the same guy. It's the same guy. And I said, wait, so he's making Flickr movies, and then he's like in a krautrock band? Wait, I don't understand.
He's German?
This doesn't make any sense. Right. So eventually, you know, this record gets put out, and in 94, a small tour was put together, a few like sort of showcase events in Atlanta, Georgia, New York, Hartford, Connecticut, Chicago, Seattle, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Death Valley. And Tony was, he was there for everything on the sort of East and Midwest. He didn't come to the West Coast. So I'd met him and I'd filmed him. And that's actually when I started filming, and was during these series of events in 1994. And so then I came back to the Art Institute and finished up my last year there. So I was a student when I started doing this stuff. And I was saying, oh, I went and met this guy, Tony Conrad, and Labatt's like, oh, Tony Conrad. Yeah, boy, I got a great story about that guy. And Tony Labatt told me about this performance. And I would love to piece together like an oral history of the people who were at this, because it's like I get every time it comes up in conversation, there's like a whole new set of details emerge, some of which I don't think I can talk about.
right.
On the record.
You know, alleged, yeah.
Alleged vast quantities of illegal substances, allegedly. But apparently, you know, Hallwalls is this very sort of famous art space up in Buffalo where a lot of performance and film work and music and stuff takes place there. And he had done this, Labatt was up there to do this performance. And the story, as I recall, is that he got all these people, he got a bus, and he got all these people on a bus and got them all really excited. We're going to go somewhere special. And got them in the bus, and they got in the bus and they started driving, and they went all the way out to Niagara Falls, which is not that far, 40 minutes. And they got everybody off the bus, and then the bus left, and that's the end of the performance. They started stranding 50 people at Niagara Falls. Allegedly, there were mass quantities of substances involved, allegedly. But I don't know about that for sure. And and Labatt was, this is how he met Tony Conrad, because he said people were freaking out. You know, this is
40 minutes.
This is
away.
In the 80s, no man. Uber. There's no Uber. You know, like you're stranded at Niagara Falls in the middle of the night. You know, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
And he said, yeah, but there was one guy who was just laughing and laughing and thought it was the funniest thing ever, and that was Tony Conrad. Right. And so that's when I knew that Tony Labatt had interacted with him. So he was very excited when he found out, you know, when I was an art student, that I was filming Tony Conrad.
Whoa.
But he hasn't seen the movie yet. he didn't make it out to our San Francisco screening. I'd hoped he would. But.
Yeah. And Jeff Hunt is the Table of Elements guy?
Jeff Hunt is the Table of the Elements guy.
So he started all that in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's good to know. Yeah, I know he's in Atlanta now, right?
He moved to Atlanta. Yeah. He was working out of Atlanta for a while. Then he was working out of, I want to say, somewhere in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And now he lives in Austin, Texas.
Okay, yeah.
And the label is not really functioning as a label. It's we like to say it's in the legacy phase.
Mm-hmm. Were you involved in the label too?
I was not involved in any curatorial or like executive decisions, but I was certainly involved in sort of production things. You know, like I shot a lot of video of a lot of concerts. I shot video of some of the studio sessions. Mm-hmm. One of my photographs even appears as artwork that's laser etched, not laser etched, silk screen printed onto a CD.
Okay. Yeah,
there was a score for a John Jost movie put out called The Bed You Sleep In, and the score was by this San Francisco composer named Erling Wold, who had composed this whole thing in just intonation, so it sort of fit the aesthetic of the label. And then I shot a series of sort of large format photographs of rusty saw blades, circular saw blades, and those circular saw blades became a motif in the packaging and the artwork. So that's the only time my artwork really ever appeared in a Table of the Elements release.
But yeah, and he figures prominently in the whole story of like this kind of, and this is interesting to me because I kind of only knew about Tony in the 90s when I didn't realize there was this whole period where he was like under-recognized or undiscovered, because I think I just kind of came on the scene like, oh, this guy, he was involved in all this stuff, and it was already known at that point. But it's interesting to be in like the early 90s, like people hadn't put together his whole connection between the filmmaking and the music and all of that and the Faust record.
Yeah, not really. I mean, a few people knew about it, but even Tony Arsler, who's one of his oldest friends, he didn't really know anything about the music.
Mm-hmm.
He really knew Tony Conrad as a video artist, you know, as a media guy, filmmaker. Didn't really know any. I mean, I remember when he saw the film, I said, I didn't know anything about this. How do you not know about this? You guys have been friends for 40 years. He's like, I just, you know, he didn't know. And then there were certain people who only really knew Tony Conrad as this drone musician. And it's been a sort of a strange dilemma in just trying to like market the movie, you know, because I'm just saying it's an artist biography. Go with that, you know, and I've had some people try to market it. It's like, well, it's an experimental film documentary. It's like, no, don't say that. No, because it's actually quite limiting, you know. I mean, he's a multimedia artist, really, is the best way to describe it. I mean, that's what you would call it. It was just... He wasn't calling himself that at the time. He wasn't labeling himself anything. I think that's part of that problem in understanding who he is in history. Is that he resisted all those kinds of labels.
Yeah.
You know, even with the Flicker, people would say, oh, it's a structuralist film or it's an experimental film. He didn't really like those terms. He's like, well, it's just a film. You know, why does it have to be, you know, called this or that? Yeah. But it was really interesting... You know, looking back now from this place that we stand, where it's like a given that these Tony Conrad records have now essentially been in, well, I won't say the popular consciousness.
Well, the canon of experimental
but yeah,
music.
But I mean, like to a certain sort of musically educated crowd, you know, these sounds are a given. Like, it's like, of course, you know, like people might even have one or two of these records. They've all heard them. Maybe they've even seen him play. But in 1993... This was like, it was all new. And it was kind of a crazy thing that Tony was just sort of dropping these tapes one after another on Jeff. And Jeff was kind of gobsmacked by this thing. Like, wait a minute, you've been sitting on all this work for all these years and it's never come out. And you know, Tony Conrad's like, well, you know, nobody really ever asked.
And it's a weird, is it like a sense of humility you think with him? Or is it almost just like he just... wanted to just like let the thing speak for itself? Or
I think it's a lot of that. I mean, and I think the other thing is that he was just so busy and engaged with the next thing,
right,
that, you know, he wasn't sort of a careful steward of his legacy or his archive, and it really sort of dawned on him really late. You know, that he's got to get this stuff together. I mean, he became very, in the last few years, it was almost kind of a frustration for him that it was just like, it had become this just this like outstanding pile of stuff. And how do we sort it through it? And how do I begin to hire someone to help me?
Right.
So it became kind of a real problem that's still somewhat unresolved as what do you do with all this? So, but Jeff really, you know, I mean, they put out, I think he told me they did something like 12 or 15 releases. It might even be more than that, considering all the little like vinyls and singles and reissues and new, different editions and stuff. But I mean, they put out the Faust record in two versions I know of. Then they put out the box set of early minimalism. And then, you know, the record that was actually commissioned for the label, which was the Slapping Pythagoras recording, which was sort of when...
Is that with,
Jeff got Tony together with Gaster Soul Gold, the Gaster Soul Gold guys, Gaster Del Sol guys.
Yeah.
Say that three times fast.
Who are both in the movie? Grubbs and
Jim O'Rourke and David Grubbs and Steve Albini as producer.
Right.
Although, you know, there's some argument about who, maybe Jim was the producer and Albini was the engineer, and you know, but typically to Albini, I think the credit says recorded by, which is usually what
he doesn't really like to throw more on there. Yeah, he likes to.
But I think, you know, Jim, when I talked to Jim, he talked a lot about just sort of being involved in some of the recording techniques that they had to engage in order to get the final product out on the record, and how that there was a little bit of a friction with Tony in that, because Tony was trying to hear, he wanted to hear these frequencies here and now. And there were certain frequencies where Jim would say, we can't record that frequency. We have to record this frequency. And then in the mix, we'll bring that frequency out. So understanding that whole process of production and post-production, that's what Jim was really kind of wrangling Tony, because Tony was really just like, patch it all together and hit record. And Jim was the one saying, listen, you have to kind of pull this back, or you have to retune this. You know, I remember Jim talking about like 220 versus 440, you know, talking about kilohertz and stuff like this for these certain frequencies. And it's like, we can't, there's certain things you just can't record and get it to sound the way you really want it to sound, you have to record it this way and then manipulate it later to get it the way you want. And so there was a lot of that that Jim was involved with in getting that record to sound the way it sounds.
You cannot enter the world of experimental art in the United States. We were talking about Tony Conrad.
This is right outside the old apartment where I used to live up there. The Velvet Underground was founded up in that apartment.
He was present at the formation of the Velvet Underground. He was an integral, crucial part of it. But, you know, like, he went on and he had other things to do.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
So your first introduction to Tony is through this guy, Jeff, and in 94, he puts out these records and brings him to California.
Tony did not come to California. I actually traveled to Atlanta, Georgia for this two-day music festival, and I sort of volunteered myself as the videographer. It was sort of one of these questions like, you know, Jeff, who's filming this? And he sort of looked at me and said, aren't you?
Like, well, good thing I brought all this gear with me.
Well, this was before we left San Francisco. So yeah. I said, well, I guess I better then.
Yeah.
And started thinking, okay, well, I need to get a camera and I need to get some tapes. And actually it was Henry Rosenthal, who I mentioned earlier, the producer of The Devil and Daniel Johnson, who Jeff and I had actually met at a screening of John Jost films at the San Francisco International Film Festival. And we sort of thrust ourselves upon Henry as young kids. And we actually begged Henry to help us pay to buy a case of Super 8 tapes, high eight videotapes to go and tape these shows. We said, Henry, I remember we had to show up at his office. We're like, Henry, please, if you don't give us any money, this will never get filmed.
So you had to get all this gear and get out to Atlanta.
And drove out to Atlanta, yeah. Rented a car, and then drove and followed the tour along filming. And, you know, this is a zero budget affair. It's sort of a funny thing. Like, if you look at these Table of the Elements CDs at the time, they're so exquisite and they're so handsomely produced, you know.
He's just an art student at the time?
No, he wasn't even a student.
Oh, he's just a
Jeff is a college dropout.
Uh-huh.
Just like bohemian guy living in San Francisco back when bohemians could afford to live in
right,
San Francisco.
Early 90s, yeah.
Yeah.
After I married an axe murderer, yeah.
Yeah, it's a long time ago. That San Francisco is long gone.
Nope, yeah.
Back when, you know, visionaries and weirdos would move to San Francisco, you know, and do bizarre film screenings or all-night sound installations.
Were you an ATA guy too?
I went to ATA quite a few times.
That's like the early 90s when I first went there.
All of that stuff. So that's that scene that's happening, right? And it's still got some of that late 80s post-punk vibe. I mean, you know, Survival Research Laboratories was still doing shows and, you know, there was still that feeling of just like experimental, industrial weirdness.
Craig Baldwin made that Negative Land movie.
Yeah, that was
then.
All still vibrant at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And a
lot of leather on hate.
Yeah. Well, lower hate.
Yeah, yeah.
If that's even a thing anymore. I think they call it Hayes Valley now.
Yeah. I don't know. So you, who was this? Was this now Faust with Tony Conrad on this trip?
Right,
like two members of Faust.
Well, Faust came out. There were three of them, and I don't. And Tony did.
There's
not
some
actually,
footage in the film.
Tony did not play with Faust in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. Then he played with Faust in New York, but did not play with them in Hartford. and then did not play with them. It was sort of interesting because Tony really sort of was playing as a solo artist on these on this event, with the exception of the one Knitting Factory show in April of 94.
That's what's in the film.
That's the one that's in the film, and it's the first time they'd actually ever played live together. You know, because it was a studio. It was a studio gig.
When they played together, that was in Germany or no? Wait, was
yeah, they made the record outside the Dream Syndicate. It was made in 72, 73 in Germany, in Boonma there, you know, in Faust's studio.
Right, like the house that like where everything's just plugged in.
Right, because Tony was actually touring and doing some gigs with Lamont Young and just was trying to find a place where he could go record some stuff that he had some ideas he wanted to try out, and someone tipped him off and said, you should go talk to these guys in Faust. And so they became the rhythm section for that record, which is really just bass and drum, you know, for Tony's drones. But getting back to the filming of it, it was just completely by the seat of our pants. I mean, I was shooting everything on high 8 consumer cameras, and then how I figured out how to get multiple angles was that, you know, other kids like me, 24, 25 year olds would show up at the gigs, bringing their own personal cameras and asking if they could film. And I'd make them a deal. Like, well, listen, if you film with my tapes and give my tapes back to me at the end, I'll give you an all access pass and all the beer you can drink. And everybody said yes. I mean, it meant that I had a lot of dubbing to do when I got home. So I had to make VHS dubs of everybody's tapes to send back to them because they all wanted a copy.
Right.
But then they were kind of into it. So that's how I was able to get multiple angles.
Okay.
Because yeah, then I could say, okay, well, if you're here, you go on that balcony and you go on that balcony and you go down here. And I was able to kind of get multiple angles, which was great because sometimes the camera, on my camera on several tapes, the sound got messed up. You know, it was like, who knows? I mean, it was like I said, it was so low budget that in a way I needed to wait until all this digital editing technology became affordable, because I had to fix stuff that would have been impossible to do in tape, the old fashioned tape to tape editing, which I had in my mind of how I would eventually put this all together, but we never did anything.
Or there might have been some timing drift or something.
Well, the tape is pretty solid. It was just a matter of getting them all synced up, you know.
And like, so how much did you interact with Tony in these trips?
Like, well, that first weekend I met him, and then I shot an interview with him. I shot a bunch of performances, and then I interviewed him. And I remember, you know, we were in the dressing room at the old Knitting Factory on Houston Street. And I asked him one question, and he gave me a 45-minute long response with, like, cross-references and footnotes. And, and I remember just, like, nodding through the whole thing, thinking, oh, my God, this guy's amazing on camera. Now, I didn't know at the time, of course, that he had been doing all this public access TV.
Right.
I didn't know that he was a video artist, often appearing in his own videos. I didn't know anything about him. I just knew him as this drone violin guy and a guy who made Flickr films. I didn't know that he had sort of cultivated himself as an on-camera personality. So that's actually, it was right after I shot that interview in 94, I went over to Jeff and I said, you know, we should really, because we had this idea we're making a great Faust documentary. And I said, you know, we really should make a Tony Conrad documentary. That guy's fascinating. And then we sort of laughed about it. And then it became a running joke. Like, yeah, when are we going to make a Tony Conrad documentary?
So you had this idea 20 years ago, 22 years ago.
Yeah, you know, things just take a while sometimes.
Yeah. So, like, yeah, that's crazy that you had that footage and then you end up making this movie down the road.
My own footage becomes the archival material.
Yeah.
If you wait long enough, you can do that too.
So when did the idea of really doing this, when did you start? Because there's a certain point where you've been shooting some stuff with him, and then a lot of the stuff is just archival footage. It seems like you started shooting stuff around 2010 or 12.
Yeah, well, I was shooting concerts as early as 94. So I have concert footage from 94, 96, 98... I don't think 99, but maybe 2002. And it was actually in 2002 that I went out and shot a bunch of interviews, additional interviews, because we had thought that there would be a deluxe reissue of, I think it was Slapping Pythagoras, where there would be a CD, DVD.
Right. When you put all the films,
double
like disc, an MPEG on
cool
a disc.
Thing, yeah. And there'd be a DVD. And I was really into this idea of the DVD where you could watch the 7 short films about Tony Conrad, and it would be in random order.
Okay.
It'd be like a shuffle order thing. Like you could watch it linear, or it's just like watch randomized, which I really love this idea that it would just play them in different orders. Mm-hmm. And so it was some performance, some interview, and they would intermix. Mm-hmm. And I've shown some of those around, those shorts, and I cannibalized some of them for the doc. And some of them never got into the doc, so they're still standalone little short videos. That all got delivered. We made the menus. We did the whole thing. It went right to the door of the manufacturer, and then they killed the project. It was just going to be too expensive to make. So in a sense, I'd sort of shot and edited. I'd kind of done the beta version of the movie, and it was all done on DV, standard def. You know, it was pretty lo-fi, and it all reverted back to me. And those are the tapes right over there behind you.
Oh, whoa.
Those bins of tapes. Those are the high 8. And DV tapes, and just, you know, it was very lo-fi, shot on consumer cameras, you know?
Yeah.
And so then it came back to me, and then I went and shot another concert in 2006.
Is this the Austin concert?
The Austin concert's in 2006.
I think I was there. Was it during South by Southwest?
It was a South by Southwest Table of the Elements showcase.
I was there.
That they did at the church, I want to say, on 8th Street.
Yeah. Arnold Dreyblatt played.
Yep, Arnold Dreyblatt was there. I have a great video of that performance, which has only screened once.
My friend Henny's was playing drums for that, I think.
Rhys Chatham did a great performance, which had Jonathan Cain on drums and Thurston Moore on guitar.
Okay, yeah.
Zena Parkins was there. Tony played solo. I know there's other people who played. I can't remember.
With the shadow and the scrim and all that
And then
stuff,
I had 5 cameras. Now, by that point... we'd graduated up to 24p DV. I was super excited about that. I was like, now I'm getting 24 frame video widescreen, you know, 16:9. It's like, so it's funny watching the formats kind of evolve. Mm-hmm. But, and that stuff held up really great when we ended up uprising it to HD. Mm-hmm. We were actually able to really get a lot of nice image out of that. But the interlaced DV footage, the 30i interlaced DV footage actually is the worst looking of all the stuff. It's got all that edge shearing and stuff.
Okay.
It looks terrible. The high 8 looks
which
so
stuff
beautiful.
Is that stuff in there? I'm trying to remember.
The first scene in the documentary is him on Ludlow Street.
Yeah,
that was shot
yeah.
on DV. And it just, you can just see it's very edgy looking. But the 24p DV and then the high 8, there's something about the high 8. When I actually converted the high 8 to 24 frame video, it just... it looks better than all the DV. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have any of the edging and any of the shearing. It just, it's smooth and it's got beautiful grain.
Yeah.
And it's sort of,
I liked like, high 8. I remember high 8 being
but
good.
But I just, it's interesting, you know, now when you sort of throw all these formats into the soup and to see which ones really come forward as looking great, it was like the high 8 totally outclassed the DV.
Yeah, all that footage of him in New York, like it, you can kind of tell, you can kind of date it a little bit. I'm like, it's sort of like obviously there's a timestamp on it, and also like I think that's around the time I've only met the guy one time, and I met him at I guess it was East Nile, right, or West Nile.
Oh yeah, he did a lot of performances.
Yeah,
there.
With Carbon, and they had a space there, and I remember like seeing him at a show. I think it was like it was a Brian Chippendale solo thing, Black Puss. And then it just took a picture. I'm like, that's Tony Conrad just kind of chilling out in the back with his hat and his like green t-shirt. And
that
I think I talked to him briefly. Yeah. I was like, hi, I know who you are. He's like, oh, cool. That was it. You know? Yeah. And then it's really interesting because that's also how you close it out. He's like that footage from that same time period, right? Because it's like him walking around New York.
Well, the final sequence of him conducting traffic was shot in HD and was part of the, you know, when I sort of approached Tony about saying, listen, let's do this. How do you feel about really doing this as a proper documentary? He said, okay, great. So I said, fine, I'm going to come out and we're going to shoot for 2 weeks and just to kind of start over a little bit. And that was from, I think, our first day out shooting. He did this traffic thing. And by that point, we were shooting in HD, and it was, you know, a whole different kind of level of production. I'd flown a cameraman out with me, and, you know.
I was going to say, you had a couple of angles, right? So you had another
That was
guy,
all shot single camera.
Oh, was?
It's it's just cut to look that way.
Oh, nice.
It's just, it's got a kind of a jump cut
And when did you have that conversation with him about, like, let's do this thing? Like, he was kind of aware that he'd known you for like 20 years as a guy filming him.
Yeah. It was really in 2010. I just wrote him an email mm-hmm. and said, you know, I'd love to do this. And he said, sure. And I remember that first time we came out and shooting, he sort of had me on probation a little bit because one of our associate producers, Scott Grotcheff, went up to Buffalo. Mm-hmm. So we shot in Brooklyn. We hung out with him in Brooklyn for a week, Brooklyn and Lower Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And then we went up to Buffalo for a week. And he was giving us a lot of grief in Buffalo.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I could think, you know, because I can only imagine he's probably got a lot of eager young people coming to him with great ideas and, you know, most of them probably don't pan out.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
So he's like, okay, sure. You want to make a film? Sure. But then I kept showing up,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I think he realized that I was serious about doing this. You know, this wasn't just like some idea that would just peter out that mm-hmm. I was going to, no, we're really doing this. And I'm coming back again in the fall. And I'd sort of go out
mm-hmm.
every 6 or 8 months to New York, you know, sort of an odd thing to be working on someone who's so affiliated with New York and Buffalo.
Yeah.
And I'm making the whole movie out of Los Angeles
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
where he's not very well known.
You yeah.
know, there's a certain group of people who know his work and obviously the art community that was here, mm-hmm. you know, Mike Kelly was close friends with Tony Conrad,
mm-hmm.
John Baldessari. I mean, some of the people in the art world kind of knew Tony and certain music people knew his work,
yeah.
but he was not really known as like an actual person like he was in New York because he was so available. He'd just walk down the street and there he is, or you'd see him riding his bike and there he is, or he was everywhere in mm-hmm. Buffalo. You know,
and you never lived in New York then.
I never did.
Yeah, you've stayed West Coast this whole time.
There were a few opportunities in my life that I could have jumped on, and I can't think about that now.
Yeah.
it's a river of regret. I'm not sailing down. So.
Okay.
No, well, you know what I mean? It's yeah. like, how my life would be completely different if I had moved to New York. That's one summer. Mm-hmm. Like you can't even go there.
Now you're saying that you've worked on other stuff, and what was the sort of the stuff that you've done that you wanted to talk about? Because you said there's stuff that you wish that people would also ask you about as much as like Devil or this.
Well, it's not so much that I don't really wish they'd ask me about. It's just they just don't.
Yeah.
But it's just fascinating to me that the Daniel Johnson film is just something that just resonates.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people have seen it. Now, mm-hmm. when it first came out, not so much. You know, I remember, it premiered in Sundance 2005. It actually opened theatrically in, I want to say, April 2006. And it did some okay business at the Sunshine in New York, but they opened it on 3 screens in Los Angeles. And it was just running to empty auditoriums. Mm-hmm. You know, But it really sort of found its audience on DVD. It's one
right.
of those movies that sort of as people were getting passed around, or you know. And I remember, you know, certain people I'd meet and like, oh, so and so gave me a copy of that, and I really fell in love with it. And I would have people find me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it also led to a lot of people wanting to hire me to do every single oddball, no budget documentary that on the planet, and I had to sort of politely turn a lot of people. Mm-hmm. down.
What other
you know,
what's other documentary stuff you've worked on? Because this is a podcast generally, you know, we talk about documentaries mostly,
of course. Yeah. Well, I mean, that was the thing, is I got very known as a documentary editor.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I was always sort of making this Tony Conrad movie in the background for mm-hmm. like most of my adult life, so it was kind of funny to finally get that out. But you know, I did that. I worked on a film called The Final Member, which was a really goofy film, fun, nutty, bizarre movie that your audience should go look up. It's okay. still on Netflix.
It's on Netflix.
Yeah, it's great. Sort of about the, well, it's not sort of about, it is about the Icelandic Penis Museum's 12-year quest to obtain a human specimen, which is harder than you think, pun intended. So that's kind of a fun movie. I really liked it. That's one that didn't really get, I think, its due.
Yeah, but that's actually streamable right now. And Devil in Daniel Johnston, I had to get a DVD from the library to watch.
Oh, really? Is that not available anywhere?
It's not on Netflix, it's not on HBO, it's not on Hulu.
But not like iTunes
or Amazon?
It's probably
on iTunes. It probably is on
iTunes.
Yeah,
you can probably rent it.
One of those, yeah.
Another film that I really liked working on was a film called Lost Angels, which is also, I believe, still streaming on Netflix, which was actually all about the community that's sort of living in Skid Row and dealing with a lot of mental health issues. Mm-hmm. That was really kind of a special film. I'm also a co-producer on that film. A lot of times I'm the writer of the movie uncredited. You know, I'm kind of insisting on writing credit more and more, but I've been sort of the ghostwriter of a lot of the movies that I've done. But that was a really special movie. It didn't really get any festival play. Mm-hmm.
It's a documentary?
It's a documentary.
About the homelessness.
Directed by a really lovely English guy named Thomas Napper, who was here. And it was made actually as an adjunct to a movie called The Soloist, which had, I want to say Jamie Foxx and Robert Downey Jr.
Right.
About and was sort of this homeless sort of, like, musician. Yeah. Hollywoodized version of Steve Lopez's book. And the movie sort of underperformed, I think. And the documentary that we made as a companion piece was kind of just chucked to the curb.
Yeah.
And we were able to just, we ended up sort of putting it out independently online. And it's a lovely, lovely piece. Mm-hmm. Really different, you know. I'm trying to think now. I've got to like remember everything I've ever worked on. I've worked with this Belgian artist who's also become a good friend of mine, a guy named Johan Grimonpre, who, before I met him, had made a film called Dial History, which is a film he made in the late 90s about the history of airline hijackings that came out very eerily before 9/11. And then I worked with him on the next film, which was a film called Double Take, which was a film that sort of posited this idea that Alfred Hitchcock in 1962 meets himself in 1980 in a sort of time shift, and they realize that one of them is living in the correct time and the other one must not survive. Like, it's a sort of impossible. It's based on a Borges story, right? And that's all kind of found footage, and we had all access to all the Alfred Hitchcock Presents and all this stuff. And so we created this sort of narrative about Hitchcock using all of the bits and pieces of his personal appearances. And then it's kind of got this whole thematic about the Cold War and the space race, Russia versus the United States, kind of mirroring television's rise and conquering of cinema. And then Hitchcock, of course, being this strange character known for cinema, who jumps into television. So it was sort of operating on a lot of different levels, and Johan's films tend to do that.
Nice.
And they're very, very difficult to put together, but because they're these very, very intricate collage films.
Double Take, that's that one.
It's called Double Take, and I think that's streaming everywhere too.
Awesome.
I mean, in terms of the kind of films I get offered, it seems, I'm kind of like the punk rock and mental illness guy, and if you can combine those two, it's even better. I mean, I was approached and asked to edit and co-produce the Bad Brains documentary, Banned in DC, sort of because of the Daniel Johnston thing, you know, because, oh, you're the mental illness guy. That's also Lost Angels, the film I was talking about, that about the people in Skid Row. It's like, oh, you know, someone, actually one of the producers wanted to hire me because it's like, because I did mental illness so well. So I thought, well, that's a good niche. You know, mental illness documentaries are never not interesting. So I can deal with that. And it sort of, you know, it helps me kind of understand myself better as a creative person. But
I've never seen the Bad Brains doc, so that came out.
The Bad Brains doc, you know, did some festivals, and I think it's on Vimeo pay-per-view. But it's not out on iTunes, not out on Amazon. I'm not sure why.
Yeah, it seems like there is a definitely demand and an interest.
I don't know what the reasoning behind that is. Even though I'm a producer on that film, I was sort of the technical and logistical producer, not the kind of admin producer. So I don't really know the business end, like why the distribution of that is narrow. I'm not sure.
Yeah. I imagine Rollins is in it.
Rollins is in it. Ian MacKay is in it.
Biafra.
Jello Biafra is not in that one. Documentary. Beastie Boys. And all three of them. Mm-hmm. Before Adam died.
Do you guys talk about the big boys thing? Is that in there?
The big boys controversy.
Is Tim in there?
Is in there.
Tim Kerr, yeah.
None of the big boys would appear on camera.
Okay.
Because they were asked.
I've talked to Tim about that. He had an interesting story about it. I wish I could remember it verbatim, but we talked about it a little bit.
Yeah.
Because we went to his house and it's like, oh, this is where it all happened in this house.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah. There's. I have a funny counterpoint to some of that, but I will maybe off.
Yeah, I mean, we don't need to get into a controversy that is like from 35 years ago.
Well, that's partly what it is. It's a controversy for some people who are still holding on to it.
Yeah. And I don't remember all the details, but yeah. Anyway, yeah. I haven't seen the film, but we could do another thing about the Bad Brains thing.
So it's funny. The Bad Brains movie was pretty fun to do. It was certainly a delight. I mean, I like doing music films because they're great to edit. You know, like I have a lot of musicality in the editing that I do, so I like doing music films. You know, some people are not that musical. I've heard people complain about. I remember somebody was complaining about an editor who couldn't cut to music, and I thought, wait a minute. I've never heard of that. Yeah. That doesn't make any sense.
Did you work on music videos, too?
I never worked on music videos. I've made some of my own, but I never worked in music videos. I mean, the other thing that's sort of unlikely about my career, if you call it that, is, you know, being a sort of experimental film person and an art student, it would have seemed likely that I would have ended up working in music videos, especially moving to Los Angeles.
Yeah. Right?
But my experience in working a little bit in, you know, sort of brushing up against that was just, I did not like the people working in music videos at all. And even in independent features, I was sort of like, this is not really the right fit for me in terms of just the people I was working with. And I sort of fell in with this nonfiction crowd and realized a lot of the people working in nonfiction were like me. They'd had degrees from art programs and they're all working in documentary. And I was like, wait, all these kind of like art people are working in documentary. It's like, oh, cause documentary is where all the smartest people are. So I want to go hang out there. And then I also sort of convinced myself, I guess, that if I can edit a documentary, I can edit anything because it's the hardest editing, you know, which I think it is. I mean, I sort of feel like everything else is a lot easier. Yeah.
Stuff you've been handling, it's like, right, it's like over decades, like multiple film formats, and then like you have to create all these interstitial things.
No script.
Right.
You know, that's kind of the thing. It's one of the things I like so much about it. It's also the thing that drives me crazy about it is, you know, you're just working without a net. You know, you have to make a movie out of a bunch of footage.
Right. You have in Tony Conrad, though, someone who likes to play to the camera, who is like really like a charismatic, interesting on-screen guy. And
that's why I wanted to make a film about him. I thought he would make my job a lot easier. And in some ways he really did. And in other ways he made it even tougher, you know, because you're talking about somebody who is a filmmaker themselves, is a media professor and a theorist really about media and who understands media and the power relationships that are at play in any kind of mediated venture, right? So I've got to take all that into account, right? Because just even a simple interview or sort of verite style filming with him on the street is always some kind of conversation about power, right? Because it's like this whole understanding of like, okay, you're standing there and you have a camera. Do you have the power over me? Because I'm standing here without the camera. But see, I'm on camera. And if I walk out of the frame, then I've taken away your power as the camera person. So there was always this kind of funny, almost like a match. We were like engaged in like some kind of a strange dialogue.
Yeah.
That we didn't talk about, but it was sort of evident, you know, because and Tony would do things like he'd deliberately walk out of the frame, you know, and then say, see, I've walked out of the frame. I've just changed the meaning of your shot. I've just, you know, like he was playing tricks on me. Not, you know, I wanted to include a lot of that in the film, and the earlier cuts of the film that had a lot of this stuff in it, it was just not really watchable. It was just not coherent. I mean, it was delightful, like, yeah, and it made me laugh, but I realized when I was trying to show this film to people who don't know him, right, because I realized that ultimately I have to make a film that's really a sort of introductory course into who he is. If you're working with a more established personality, I think that in some ways you can bend those rules more. But I had to kind of hone him in. And it's funny, there's been some reviews here and there that sort of like think they're knocking the film by saying it's sort of oddly conventional. This film takes a conventional approach to an unconventional subject. But for me, I thought, well, actually, because I wanted to make a 3-hour, like, annoying, opaque, unwatchable documentary about Tony Conrad, which I thought would be like a legendary film that no one's ever sat through. There was something really appealing about making that. Like, I'll be the guy who made this film no one could get through. And it'll just become notorious for its own. But then I thought, you know, that's about me.
Right.
That's not about Tony. And the point of making this whole film was to bring the world to Tony Conrad's work, his music, his film, and get everybody seeing that work that might be considered experimental or difficult actually isn't, and is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And that he's a lot of fun, and that you can have a lot of fun challenging these kind of paradigms and stuff. And so I thought, really, I wanted to make this movie for like my 18-year-old self, you know, like, or my 16-year-old self, or like, or a 20-year-old, but somebody who's just getting into art and wants to get sort of more inspired by ideas. So I made the film kind of more about that. I mean, I still stuck a few little funny digressions in there, but I minimized those a lot, you know, and because I realized they were just annoying. I mean, people who didn't know his work, just they didn't even know what they're looking at, because the whole thing was so anarchic, the early cuts. So I had to rein that in. And then I started thinking, oh, but see, the more subversive thing I do is I make a conventional film that looks, or like film that looks like a conventional film about this guy. So then I started thinking, this is like my Trojan horse strategy. Because if it looks nuts and experimental and self-consciously arty, you know, like, and it's annoying, it's a turnoff, right? So I had to dial that back and kind
that
of
instinct that you had.
And kind of, well, yeah, I mean, I wanted to see, would this work? And it was very clear. It's like, no, this is not working. It's not helpful. It's not helping. You know, it's just like, this is just annoying. I want to seduce the audience.
Yeah.
You want to bring them in and you want to get them on your side. And then that's when you start kind of like, you know, tilting things.
Yeah.
Screw abstract art. I'm going to make art funny, happy, energetic, joyful.
I don't think he's an easy artist to take, you know. He's always gone against the grain.
This episode is brought to you by Philo. Do you love TV? Do you love saving money? Then Philo is your solution. Philo has shows, movies, and live TV for just $25 a month. You can even try it for free with their 7-day free trial. No contracts, no commitments, no hassles. Just a better way to watch TV. Never miss a minute of shows like the hit docuseries Where is Wendy Williams? Or classics such as Friends. If you can't get enough TV, then there's no better way to watch. Philo has more than 70 channels like BET, MTV, and AMC. And the best part? You can try it yourself with their 7-day free trial. Sign up today at philo.tv/poppods. That's philo.tv/poppods to get 50% off your first month.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Well, I thought that I knew A little bit. I thought I knew a bit about him. Like, I knew about the stuff with Lamont. Mm-hmm. I knew about him and Henry Flint doing those protests, which, like, I felt like that could have been a whole, like, mini doc too. Just like those weird protests they were doing against the Lincoln Center.
Yes, yeah. Yes, centers of high art and culture.
And then how, like, that he's just there. He's just like, I'm sickened by this. I got to get out of here. It's like, it looks nice now. But all the stuff about him as a media professor and, like, doing, like, the homework help and all of that stuff with, like, Buffalo, all this work he did at Buffalo. I didn't know about any of that stuff. I didn't know about the Flickr film either. I came to him more as a music guy. I remember going to a thing.
Yeah, there's a lot of people who have a similar experience mm-hmm. as you, for sure.
Well, I didn't know about like the stuff where he's like cooking film, all that stuff. I'm like, this is all great stuff. And yeah, he just was like kind of all genres of things. He was doing stuff in every genre, which is pretty nuts.
Yeah, it's all over the map. And right. I think that because self-promotion was not something he was interested in, and because he was working in this kind of crazy interdisciplinary multimedia way, really in the 60s and 70s and even in the 80s, before that was even really considered a valid avenue of practice. Mm-hmm. You know, now it's like multimedia is and interdisciplinary are, you know, those words have been kind of canonized over the last, I don't know, probably in the last 20 years maybe.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Prior to that, it was sort of like, if you're not one thing or another thing, where do you really fit in the mm-hmm. dialogue?
Yeah.
And I mean, for younger artists, it's just not an issue because everybody's working in a kind of interdisciplinary way mm-hmm. now, it seems like. I mean, you know, like you can make Snapchat art mm-hmm. if you're really clever.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you could do it. This is like everything is up for grabs now. But he was kind of, you know, saying that. And a time when people were like, wait a minute, you're just cooking film and presenting it as a melted object and calling it a movie, or the yellow movies, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. you know, which are just such a wonderful thing. That's an idea that actually really clicked mm-hmm. 30 years later. These are the paintings mm-hmm. that are essentially, for those who haven't seen the film, the paintings that are in the shape of a film screen that are meant to slowly discolor mm-hmm. over years and years and years. So the idea was to make a 50-year-long movie that would sort of go beyond the apparatus, right. the mechanical apparatus of cinema that we're so accustomed to.
Yeah.
So it's a very slow motion film. And is it a painting? Is it a movie? It's both.
Yeah.
But curators can't wrap their heads around that. So
yeah.
They have to call it an object. Well, or yeah. right? They don't know. It's me.
And stuff like that kind of, to me, like it makes sense with, like, if you think about drone as a music form and then like duration, these long durational things in visual.
Yeah, but
like
that's one thing I remember I was talking with someone about, like, maybe mm-hmm. his medium is actually duration, mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. time as a medium.
Yeah.
You know, not a constraint.
And then
actual medium.
Which is great when you put this film together, it's got footage from like an entire life. I mean, that's the thing that I saw was similar to Devil and Daniel Johnston, where you're like taking all, you know, you're building this biography out of all this stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, the Daniel Johnston movie was different. That was a little bit more conventional because, you know, even though it was a very long edit, you know, we're sort of constructing the film and reaching back into all these other people's personal collections. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Conrad film for me was like, yeah, it was 22 years of my life of filming. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, you know, 6 years actively at the end of making it into a documentary. Mm-hmm. But there was that false start with the sort of nonlinear DVD that we tried to do in 2002. So mm-hmm. it's like there was always some kind of idea of mm-hmm. something about. But that's and how oddly mimetic that whole thing is. Like, of course, you know, the only way to make a Tony Conrad documentary is it has to take 2 decades. You know, otherwise it's a cheat.
And like, did you show him different cuts of it? And did he give you any feedback on it? Or you just didn't
show him?
He never saw a cut at all. Okay. You finished a cut after he died? Or no, you finished cut right before he died?
Like the day before.
That's crazy. That must have been.
I mean, I sent him
a
link. Uh-huh. He was already in hospice care. Oh, I mean, it happened very quick. I mean, he had been dealing with health issues for a while, and we could see that he was getting weaker. But like anybody who's dealing with a long-term illness, he, you know, when you contract something that's more immediate, that you can't get over, and he got a case of pneumonia, and his immune system was not able to fight it. It just went fast.
Yeah.
And, you know, he canceled the gig, and like a week later was in hospice, and a week later was dead. It was sort of like that. And and I was getting updates from people over there, and I send him a link. And by the time I send him a link to the rough cut, whatever the most current one I had at the time, he was too sick to watch it. I think I'd heard that they watched it, you know, in the hospice room on a computer.
Whoa.
But he slept through it.
Right.
Kind of. He couldn't really watch it.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I have very mixed feelings about that.
Yeah. I mean,
I always knew that he would be absolutely the toughest critic that I would ever face. And I was sort of terrified of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like in a way he gave me a pass. But he also really trusted me eventually. You know, he never asked to see anything.
Yeah.
Even when we'd shoot, I'd say, hey, do you want to see this thing we just did on, like, playback on the camera? No. I don't want to see it. He never wanted to see it. He was interested in, for instance, the transcripts of his interviews. He never wanted to watch them, but he was very happy to get the text printed out. Because that's what he was caring about. The other stuff, he's like, I don't need to watch this. I know. He knew what I was doing. That's what I mean. For someone who was so media savvy, he knew what I was filming. He always knew where the edge of the frame was. I don't know. He's like, how does he always know that?
Yeah.
I'm like, a camera's 20 feet away on a telephoto lens, and he knows where the edge of the frame is. This is so crazy. I don't know. Like, there was just an awareness that he had, and I think he knew what I was shooting. He knew what I was putting together. And
he even pulled you into that scene in the classroom where, like, he's like, oh, this Tyler, he's making a movie about me right now.
Right, which is totally spontaneous. You know, and just like the scene at the end of the film where he's conducting traffic, you know, was completely spontaneous. You know, I've had a lot of people saying, well, not a lot, but a few folks saying, well, he's just copying John Smith's Girl Chewing Gum, which is, you know, a famous English film from the early 70s, which is, you know, a street scene that's got a voiceover kind of narrating the things that are happening in the street scene. It's a great movie. But that was done very differently. You know, that was a piece of film that had the sound added on later. This thing with Tony conducting traffic was really a response sort of to his environment and against my suggestions, you know, because I was always sort of like trying to suggest things to talk about and topics and like, let's go to this intersection and talk about authority, you know, the symbolism of a street intersection as a model of authority or I don't know, whatever, some nonsense.
And he just like,
and he kind of like thought about that for a second, and I could see he sort of just mentally spit it out and decided he was going to do something else.
Yeah.
And this conducting traffic just spontaneously happened. He was on the opposite corner from us, and he just got this wild hair to start doing it. And so it was an invented complete, there was no, you know, no discussion about it.
Yeah.
No premeditation. It just happened. It just happened while we were rolling. And that was sort of the way I dealt with filming him, was just keep the camera rolling because we're going to work through some bad ideas and a good idea will emerge.
This is like almost like, it's interesting because I think about like the, you know, when you talk about like improv stuff, that's like all these lessons that people get from improv. It's
sure.
just like first thought, like just reacting in the environment. And it's like interesting because when I think of improv in like two ways, there's like the music improv world, which I kind of know from like music stuff. And then like the comedy improv world, I'm just like, I don't really ever see those things overlap. But now I think about it, I'm like stuff like Tony. I'm like, cause I was even thinking, I'm like, did Tony like Andy Kaufman? I imagine he would have like really been interested in that stuff too. You know?
Yeah.
Like,
it never came up, but I mean, you're talking about performance and there's no doubt that he was a performer and a skilled and experienced performer. And he just, like that
riffing,
thing, that thing, yeah, it was like, okay, let's try that. That didn't work very well, but oh, here's another idea that's kind of an iteration of that that's a little better. And then we sort of hooked on something that works. You know it. Mm-hmm. He knows it. We knew it. It was like, this is working.
Yeah. And then that you found a good way to close everything out. So, yeah.
And that was that was on our first day of shooting. And I you know, I knew that was a piece of magic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lovely way to end the piece.
Yeah. And then when... So that all, yeah, like the timing is very weird that all happened because it was a very sudden thing. His death was really sudden.
Yeah, and I didn't want to put anything in the film acknowledging that he had died.
I was thinking about that too, because, yeah.
I mean, there was a moment where I thought, do I do that? And then I sort of slapped myself and it's like, well, no, of course not. Mm-hmm. Because that would, first of all, go against the title of the film.
Right. That's a good point. Yeah.
You know, and secondly, it's like, I don't want this. This is not a tombstone. No. I want the film to feel like a living document.
And it does. It does feel like, I'm like, this is like.
Like it's eternal. Great, it's happening now. It's happening then. It's happening in the future. It's kind of like, because the whole idea, we sort of take time and mush it all up and make it kind of like it's historical, but it's also like not kind of nonlinear as well.
It's like a tribute, but it, and like there's like stuff in it that it's not like hinging on a nostalgia the way maybe a lot of the punk documentaries do. I feel like,
yeah, I didn't want there to be any sense of nostalgia about it at all. I wanted it to feel like, you know, like taking that title to heart really and making a film that just feels like it's all it's all happening now, even though you're looking at 50 years worth of work. It's all happening right now.
The ideas feel constantly fresh. Like the prison stuff, that was very, I didn't know anything about that stuff. And just like that weird durational thing you're talking about of like him working on that in what, like 82 and then coming back to it with the same guys.
Yeah, like 30 years seemed to be kind of like a thing with him. And there was 30 years in the prison film, 30 years from the first exhibition of the Yellow Movies to the next exhibition of the Yellow Movies. 30 years really between
even like the Faust records coming out.
Well, but 30 years really between, say, the work that he was doing in the mid 60s, that work, like early minimalism. Four Violins is recorded in 1964 and was released in 95, 96. So that's what I mean. It's like
he just shows that he's totally ahead of his time all the time.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the thing. If you listen to the Four Violins recording, and here's the thing that's great now. It's just about all this music. You can just go on YouTube and listen to it right now. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, but back in the day, you know, it was sort of like lost music or hard to find. I mean, when this stuff was coming out on CD, people were still mail ordering through British music magazines. That's how you'd get it. You'd have to get The Wire or Mojo or, know, or Alternative Press, maybe. Remember, I mean, that was a big one in the 90s. You know, now it's on the internet. And I think in a way, it's like the time had arrived for people to be ready for this movie.
Oh yeah, like you could now put out like those, like you put out a 2-hour drone and it wouldn't be hit by the physical limitation of the format or have to be like a 3-disc set or something.
Well, there
like
was that, something that just came out this year, kind of right around the anniversary of his death, which was the Music in the Mind of the World project, which is something that Jeff Hunt had wanted to do for years, but it was technically and physically impossible because it's a 200-hour-long recording, recorded over like 4 years or 5 years or something like this. But of course, in the world of the internet, it's totally doable. So it was actually put out through a website, and there's a YouTube channel for it too. So you can actually have all of it stream, and it's done in sections. They're done in short movements, so it's a series.
It's like a playlist.
It's a playlist, yeah. So it's a series of recordings that are all dated. And you can hear, and it's Tony on piano. There's a reference to it very briefly in the documentary where he says, I didn't play violin. I just messed around on piano for 5 years.
Banging on his elbows. Yeah.
Well, that was what that project was.
Okay.
Was this sort of like 5 years of him teaching himself piano and recording all of it. Well, that was put out, early this year in April of this year. And I haven't gotten through all 200 hours of it, but I mean, that was, again, it was sort of like these ideas that the technology just didn't exist for some of these ideas to be realized the way that they needed to be realized. Even Tony would talk about some of his old films. He's like, he couldn't put them out in the way he wanted to until, for instance, he could digitally transfer some of these films and edit them digitally because it was, but it would have been too impossible to try to do it optically.
Yeah.
You know, in the old way.
And
I experienced some of that. There were certain things I could just simply couldn't assemble until I had access to inexpensive digital editing. I mean, I moved to Los Angeles in 1995 and started working on Avids and started to compile some of this Tony Conrad material, but I was bouncing Hi8 tapes to Beta SP tapes, and then trying to edit after hours on Avids that I worked on day jobs. Mm-hmm. And it was a very convoluted, complicated process. It's not until, you know, Final Cut Pro comes along and hard drives are cheap enough that you can have, 300 hours of material in HD and editing it at your house, I had to wait to for the technology to become affordable and doable and reasonable.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're saying something about how it was hard for Tony to even be his own archivist. And is there still some kind of issues around that? Like, who is kind of officially his archivist now? Or are you kind of in that role to some
I am degree? Not in that role at all. There's a group of trusted people in New York and in Buffalo who are in charge of that. They're working out some legal stuff. There wasn't a trust set up, so there was a will, and it had to go through all the state procedures with the will, and it's become complicated.
Probate and stuff.
It's become sort of complicated with that. But there is an archive, and there are a series of releases that are being planned. Mm-hmm. Audio recordings. They just released a couple months ago. The recording of 10 Years Alive on the Infinite Plane, that was recorded in 72 or 73. I'm not sure. I can't remember. Mm-hmm. But one that was done with Rhys Chatham and Laurie Spiegel. A recording that was thought to be unusable or lost or something like that, and it sort of surfaced and was kind of restored, and Jim O'Rourke did some work on it, cleaned it up, and they reissued it on double vinyl and a CD, and it's a beautiful... beautiful thing. So, I mean, that's the thing, is like stuff is still coming out. There's
like
a series,
Tupac.
Like Tupac. No, there are records that have been made that haven't been released.
Yeah.
He did a record with Jennifer Walsh, who appears in the film, and we don't know when that's going to be released. So, I mean, there's kind of a pipeline of stuff, and not to mention just films that are still being restored. I mean, there's a film that I've never even seen called Coming Attractions. I've read about it in all the books, and Brandon Joseph's book talks a lot about it, but I could never get Tony to give me even a crappy copy of it, because sometimes I was always asking Tony, can I get a copy of this and a copy of this, and I sent him a long list of all the stuff. I'd gone through all the different books where he was featured in. I sort of checked off all the works that I really wanted to go through, and then he'd sort of send me, this is impossible, I can't do that, this is too much, you're asking for far too much, this is... And then I'd say, well, just, whatever you can. Mm-hmm. And then months would go by. And then I remember I just got this really crappy looking recycled envelope wrapped up in tape. And I opened it and shook it out. And there were just two completely different mismatched thumb drives in there. And it was like 45 different works on film and video that he just, and they were all different funky resolutions.
Right.
Just,
yeah.
And I even tried to, and some of those went into the final film. We just did our best to clean them up because I tried to get better copies. And he said, what do you want? I sent it to you already.
Man,
I'd heard that was his archive. He carried he had a plastic bag full of thumb drives. And that was his archive of films.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he was really not careful with that stuff in a way, even though it mattered greatly to him, the work, and that it be preserved, but he was not the person to do it.
Right, right. And because especially old video stuff, you got to update the formats and back them up and stuff.
So that's a big job, and they're trying to figure out how to do all that.
Mm-hmm. And so you've had a couple of screenings. You did a big screening at the Broad. That was... a while about
in March we did a screening with the Broad Museum here in LA, and it was at the Ace Theater downtown, and it was really, really lovely. We screened the film, and then Henry Rollins sort of moderated a discussion between Tony Arzler and myself, and then afterwards Kim Gordon did a solo performance with a new video work by Tony Arzler about Niagara Falls, and it was mesmerizing. It was incredible. We sold 1,000 tickets to that.
Whoa.
It was really cool. And the thing that was so great about that, and just the way the Broad sort of organized that, is by, putting Henry Rollins and Kim Gordon and Tony Arzler into this universe, they're sort of telling you what this other material is. If you like all these people, you're going to like this.
Right.
And I know there's not 1,200, I mean, there were almost 1,300 total people in the auditorium. And I know there aren't that many Tony Conrad fans in Los Angeles. It's just statistically impossible. So I know a lot of people got turned on to him that night. It was really a spectacular event, the best thing we've done.
Yeah. And so now, in terms of like releasing, what are you sort of seeing is your plan with where the movie is going to live now?
Or? Well, you know, according to all the experts in film distribution, we're doing everything wrong, but the film is still playing all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of been the thing that is really exciting. You know, like we just did a screening in a little gallery in sort of Midland, England. That happened last night. But we've also just been in the New Zealand Film Festival. We're going to be at the Milan Film Festival. I mean, we've been at Rotterdam and other places like this, doing a big event in Berlin on December 1st.
Okay.
Similar to what we did here in Los Angeles with an interview, I think, portion and some sort of big name music acts. And then the idea is that we're supposed to be theatrically in 10 cities in Germany in January. So it's really playing so well outside of the United States. It's funny, you know, I was sort of telling my producers when they were kind of getting their hopes up about stuff in the US, and I said, listen, I have a feeling we're not going to play that well in the United States, but we're going to play really well outside the United States. And my prediction turned out to be sort of more than true. You know, like we actually performed worse than I thought we would in the US and far better than I thought we would overseas.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I could see like any kid, like any art school kid being interested in it. I could see libraries wanting copies. You know, there's all these other ways you can get. Are you going to try and do a DVD version?
Yeah, it's all up for discussion. But I mean, like the film is sort of still touring. So in a way, you know, when we were getting a lot of like, or not a lot of festival love, we just, you know, my producer, Paul Williams, who's kind of the UK producing arm of this, you know, he's been a rock and roll tour manager. He toured Crispin Glover all over Europe doing his, you know, because the only way to see Crispin Glover movies is you have to go to the event where he is in person, personally presenting it. But they make their money that way because they can charge a premium on the ticket.
Yeah.
And it's an event and it gets people out, and he's always selling to full houses, you know, selling out the house. So we sort of were using this model. So we did a live, we did a concert at the UK premiere at the Tate Modern.
Oh yeah, Tate Modern.
And we had a special sort of premiere event in Tokyo last year where Jim O'Rourke debuted a brand new composition and KG Hino played the soundtrack to The Flicker. We've had events sort of all over. We did something, I mean, there have been other promoters have kind of picked up on this idea and got kind of local experimental musicians to play a set after a screening. And that's kind of been the way the film's been touring around. So we've been kind of booking the film like we'd book a band on tour.
Right. And that's going to work better in Europe than here. Because it's like we're going to have a minimalist drone person.
Well, you'd be surprised. I mean, we had people in Tucson who had like a micro cinema who did a whole night dedicated to Tony Conrad and brought musicians out. We've had people in, where was it? Somewhere in Illinois we did it.
Yeah.
There have been some screenings here where they've done that.
Yeah,
and we've—it's interesting. Like we're part of the an upcoming music festival, for instance, in the UK. You know, we played as part of the Big Ears Festival,
right?
Right. Yeah. So music festivals have really been into showing this film more than film festivals,
right? Right.
So we're fine with that, you know, because
you know, it's punk rock.
It's more of a rock and roll movie. Yeah. I mean, people—that's the thing. Is like, you know, if it's not sold well, people think it's a documentary about an experimental filmmaker and they stay away. But, you know, you put rock stars on the bill and people show up and realize that it's a movie about an artist who worked in a lot of different mediums and didn't care. You know, he didn't limit himself to media. And and that's the thing, in a way, I wanted to make a film about an artist for artists. You know, a lot of my friends who are artists who've seen this movie feel like they just get like a jolt of electricity, like shot through them by the movie. You know, like that was just
totally.
Like I've had people tell me, like, after your film, I went home and wrote two songs, you know, or after your film, I went home and painted all night.
Yeah.
You know, and that's like the best thing, because I didn't want to make a documentary, an art documentary that felt like a textbook.
Right.
And it's there are a lot of them out there, and I've seen a lot of them, and they just feel like, and that's the end, close the cover, put that back on the shelf. No, I wanted to make, like I said, a film that feels like a living document, that feels like a bolt of lightning when it hits you.
Yeah. I think you get all that inspiration that he kind of generated in other people too. And they're like the way Jim O'Rourke talks about him, or the way,
right,
you know, even like the fact that you dedicated like 22 years to doing this.
Right.
It all comes across. And you kind of view him as a kind of a mentor, I think, in something you wrote. Yeah.
Right, right. I mean, kind of inadvertently, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, just by working on this film for so long and spending time with him, but also just sort of seeing his attitude about things, you know, that he, mm-hmm. he didn't get hung up on perfectionism
yeah.
at all. And I think that's such a good lesson.
That is. Because
I've worked with people who get really, really hung up on perfectionism, and you can't get any momentum going.
Yeah.
It's a really tough thing. And I just sort of like let's just start, and if it's all crap, fine, we'll get to the good stuff. It happened, you know, like really trusting that creative process.
Yeah,
like, just, you know, there are no bad ideas, it's just there's just better ones, mm-hmm. you know, and we'll find them, and when we find them, we'll know.
Yeah.
You just trust and have that trust in that process. And he was just, it was just always so great, you know, being around that level of energy. You know, I mean, he'd certainly reject stuff that wasn't working, but it was sort of like all in the spirit. I'm like, well, that's not okay. That's not so okay. Let's try this.
You've got a great impression of him also over the years. You've built up a good impersonation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, yeah. Oh, I don't know. Well, let's not do that. No. I know. Yeah. And then, you know, something.
Awesome. Do you feel like you guys were friends?
I think that we did become friends, mm-hmm. even though we were sort of, I don't want to use the word adversaries. That's not really right.
He was very aware of
it. It's kind of like if he was somebody that I was like an opponent in a match. Like, we'd come to play this game and we understood our roles.
The film game, yeah.
Yeah, like, I'm the portraitist and you're the subject and these are the roles we play. And then when we were not filming, we'd go out to dinner and it'd be a very different dynamic.
Yeah, yeah.
But when we were filming, it was sort of like, we're in our roles.
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes that blended and part of the or blurred, I should say. And part of the reason was that sometimes I would just like bring stupid little cameras and we just go to a coffee shop and we'd play, like we'd like shoot on a flip camera and pass it around, and it became like a game, mm-hmm. and it was all about sort of breaking down this idea of the formalism of you know, I'm the shooter and you're the one on camera, and like, mm-hmm. you know, like, fuck all that. And that's why he liked to sort of turn the tables on me, you know. He talks about in the Studio of the Streets, mm-hmm. Public access show that he was doing, this idea of always show the cameras in the shot, always show the microphones in the shot, announce to people that the means of production are not unattainable. Mm-hmm. You know, they're simple.
Yeah.
You know, like, let the seams show, because if you see the seams, you see how easy it is. And he always had this thing where he would never tuck the wire from his lavalier mic into his shirt.
Oh, when you guys were shooting him.
When I would
out?
Shoot with him, he'd always leave the wire dangling out. And I conceptually, I was fine with that, because it's like, right, who are we fooling? We all know we're making a film. This is not like a hidden camera.
Yeah.
But he caught it on something and broke it, and it was a $200 part replacement. And so then I said, okay, Tony, you have to tuck it in, because you're breaking the gear. And then he respected that. He's like, oh yeah, we don't want to break anything, because, you know, it's like every dollar counts. So we don't want to break the gear. I'll tuck it in for that reason, you know. But he wouldn't tuck it in, you know, for aesthetic purposes, because the aesthetic was, no, let everything show. There's no hiding.
Let it all hang out.
And so that whole idea of busting the frame open, like talking to me while we're shooting, pulling me into the shot, mm-hmm. Doing that sort of, and I wanted to leave that stuff in the film because it's kind of announcing the process all the time.
Yeah.
You know, making you aware that we're making something, and we're aware that we're making something, and you're aware that we're aware.
Dude,
and, you know.
That's how I podcast. Like, I'm like, let's turn the air conditioner back on, and then we're just going to have that in the background. So, yeah. No, this is really an inspiring film. And I mean, as someone who I thought was kind of knowledgeable about Tony, I learned so much stuff I didn't know at all. And I would definitely encourage anyone to seek out this film. And where's the best place to get it right now?
We're touring around. I mean, the best thing is follow our website, our Facebook page. Mm-hmm. We're TonyConradMovie.com and the same thing, Tony Conrad Movie on Facebook. And there are screenings popping up all the time. Mm-hmm. And you can have a screening. I mean, half of the screenings we've done have been people just cold emailing us saying, hey, we've got an art gallery, or we've got a music society, or I run a cinema club, or can we screen your movie?
Awesome.
And we make it work. And we've got Blu-rays, we've got QuickTime files. And so that's what we've been doing. And that was sort of also in the spirit of Tony. It's like, yes, we've been at the Tate Modern. Mm-hmm. Yes, we've been at the Broad Museum. We've been at very, you know, fancy art institutions, but we've also been in storefront micro cinemas and pop-up galleries where people hang a sheet, you know, and that's been the most fun. It's like, we're making the movie available that way.
Yeah.
And I'm a big proponent of seeing films on the big screen. I mean, I think every filmmaker would probably say that, although I'm guilty of watching most stuff on airplanes because that's when I have the most uninterrupted time to actually sit down and watch stuff. But I really did make this film for a big screen. The sound is mixed using all six channels of that 5.1 soundtrack. So like when we've been able to have a big screen with an incredible sound system, it's a really intense experience because we play this thing back very loud. It's meant to be played back like a concert film. And we try to encourage people to like really invest in
getting the
sound system right. And if you can play it in 5.1, you know, because there is stereo surround stuff flying around your head, you hear, you know, you can sort of see the music moving around the room on purpose. We mixed it that way quite deliberately. So we're trying to encourage people to do that, you know, like host a screening. You can book the film that way. Because once it's on the internet, once it's streaming, you know, most people are watching it on a laptop, or some people, you know, have a home theater system that's set up really well and it looks and sounds great. But it's really great. And the visuals are meant to be sort of projected large. They're sort of deliberately hypnotic.
So December 1st in Berlin.
December 1st in Berlin.
Go to the website and get in touch directly with Tyler, and maybe you can set up a screening in your town.
Or university.
Or university or library or anything.
Or library. Yeah, and we're doing that all over the place.
Awesome.
It's all up for grabs.
DIY. All right. Thanks so much, Tyler. Thanks for letting me into the house. Let's turn that air conditioner on.
Yes, of course.
And pick up some room tone. Awesome. Thanks so much. Bye. Sure. Thanks for listening.
You can find more episodes of SupDoc, show notes, updates, and more at supdocpodcast.com.
We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at supdocpodcast.
If you have comments, corrections, or want to suggest a documentary, email us at supdocpodcast@gmail.com.
The show is listener supported. You can donate to the show at patreon.com/supdocpodcast.
If you can't donate financially, please subscribe, comment, or tell a friend about SupDoc.
We'd like to thank Documentary News for their ongoing support.
SupDoc is produced by Will Scovel.
Our theme music is by David Siegel.